Okay, today is September 19th, and we covered Moshe's background, Moshe's apprehensions at the Sne. Last class we did week 3 and 7, you see, 3 and 7, which is Moshe and Aharon, which really covers Moshe et Vayikra Perek Yud, okay, with his dispute with his brother about whether he was right or wrong in not eating the meat. Okay? Now, what I'm about to do, I stand with trepidation when I use my moral philosophy or my approach to any meat, anger or whatever it may be, and I'm judgmental of Moshe Rabbeinu. This is what I would have done. Or this is what someone, a better leader, would have done. Please. You know, it's... You know, but we're still commentaries, and we... You know, we have the right to reserve some ability to read with some independence of what we see before us. We just better make sure we're philologically correct. You know what I mean by that? That we're approaching the text appropriately. You don't want to make what looks like a chiddush and then just realize that chiddush reads the word wrong. Right? Christianity built a religion on that. Okay, we may feel that it's right, but you got to make sure that you're philologically correct, grammatically correct, syntactically correct. You know what I'm saying? Don't make things up. It's got to fit the text. Now, there were some very clever commentaries, like Ibn Ezra, who was good at saying, I know this is a rare usage of this word, but look how this word is used here in the Nechemya. It may be used here in the Torah the same way, which is amazing, considering that the Nechemya is 1,000 years after the Torah. Would you say, look how this word is used in Beowulf? We can use it today in the same way. Or Canterbury Tales, look at how that root works. So that's what it means in the Constitution. Who would say such a thing? Right? Okay, I will tell you that the Hebrew language, yeah, I don't know if you ever thought of this, but there's a testament to how we have always been learning Torah. We've never had a year where many, many thousands of Jews were not learning Torah. The word sulam appears in Sefer Bereishis, right? It still means what it meant there 3,000 years later. Even though, get this, the word never appears again in the entire Tanakh. Not just the entire Torah, the entire Tanakh. It's a modern Hebrew word for goodness sakes. And by the way, spoken Hebrew fell out of use for a long, long time. Yiddish took over as the main language the Jews were speaking in their homes. Right? You wrote in Hebrew, but you spoke at home in Yiddish. Right? Anyway, I'm digressing. So Ibn Ezra was good at making this, you know, reading this based on the nuance of how the word is used someplace else. That's just a digression right now. I'm coming back to recognizing Moshe's problems, isn't it? In week 4, which is challenges in Sefer Shmos, there'll be plenty in Sefer Bamidbar also. And actually, all the 5 that we're dealing with are in Sefer Shmos, but we'll of course, we can't disregard Korach or Moshe in Iraq or things like that appear in Sefer Bamidbar. But here, the trepidation with which I spoke of, I'm taking you through the Perush of Rashi. I start with the Bechor of all Parshanut about Moshe, and I believe that you will be reminded when we do this, because you're all here and we spoke about this. I believe you will be reminded of the 3 events that we spoke about, the foreshadowing of Moshe's leadership qualities in the 3 stories where he has the Mitzri and the Ivri, Shnei Anoshim Ivrim, right? Remember, Ish Mitzri, Ish Ivri, remember we spoke about Milat Mancha of Ish, remember that? And 3, the Ro'im and the Benos Israel. Okay. Although he's called Reuel there, but that's for another time. Okay? So I just know that whoever the father of these girls is, his name is Yisro, because he marries one of them, and Yisro is called his father-in-law. He may also be called Reuel, right? But more likely, Reuel is Yisro's father. And we refer very often, so many examples of this. Child is a great child, it's okay. Ben Bono, come on, Bono. Right? Okay. I don't mean that halachically, right? A Kohen who is the child of... a Kohen who is the child of someone's daughter can't go to his funeral. Right? My daughter married a Kohen, right? Their son cannot atame to me. So it's like my Ben Bono, he's not a Bono in that case, you know what I'm saying? Because I've heard that it's a psak that has come out of some people who allow grandchildren, Kohanim, to go to funerals. It's ridiculous. But would you make this up just anywhere because the Gemara says that the grandchild is like a child? Because look, those Yisro refer to their grandfather as their father. Well, Abihen, right? You can't matame to your father. You can't ignore it. The halacha say you can matame to your grandfather. Anyway, I'm doing a lot of digressing today. You see, these three stories are indicative of the rest of Moshe's relationship with his people. What is this? The third story of Moshe saving the girls from... Yeah, how Moshe will deal. Klabichutz. There may be some stories where it's like Yonah going to Nineveh. I don't know. Where it's diplomacy with other nations. That's really towards the end of the Torah. But maybe also, you know, right after they left Egypt. Or it is dealing with Paro. With just doing what's right. Even when no Jew is involved. Okay? Alright, so, but you all agree that in these three examples, he certainly got the job done here. Saved the Hebrew. He gets the job done here. Well, we discussed this already, right? He really gets the job done there. He marries one of them, right? Okay? But in the second one, not so much. Right? We talked about what Aaron would have done in the second story, right? But that's Shalom. Someone who can make an Egel, for the reason we discussed last class, can also go over the two people and say, you know, he really wants to be an Egel. So that's what Aaron can do. But Moshe is MS, and it emerges even in his youth. Moshe can't do that. Not that he can't be taught, but it's just not in him. I just can't do that. I can't fake it. I can't. I'm incapable of doing it. It's like Spock showing emotion. You know, I can't. But I don't know. There is somewhere he does, I guess. I don't know. But I can't do it. Right? So because he represents Emes, which really not doesn't know how to bend. It's incapable of bending. Right? Something that's mathematical and that's true, you can discuss whether a particular ideology is true or not, but you can't discuss whether 3 plus 4 is 7 or not. If it's endless, it's endless. I'll admit that today what's true and truth is, you know, is up in the air. Some things, right? Is it true science? Is it fake science? Is it fabricated science? Is it that's going on in the world today, I'm sorry. And here is the Rashi I'm taking you to. And let's work on it now. We're doing some cases. And Rashi says that for all of the midos that a human being has, I think a good collection of this would be the what's called Orchos Tzadikim. Did you learn that in Musar time, in your yeshiva, when they were in Israel? Unknown authors, some say it's the Rosh. Orchos Tzadikim gives you in his introduction 45 different gates. Even better than the Silas Yisharim, 45 different gates of human behavior. There's a Shara Kaas, Shara Hahudah, Shara. It means like a very organized Michtav Eliyahu or something like that. You know, maybe it's more modern, or Musar. There are all kinds of books written in the last few hundred years. to hone in your personality. Okay. So the it looks, if you really read it right, anybody here, you haven't heard of Orchos Tzedekim? Really? No, my goodness. Very popular in like you have Thursday night for half hour, or some rabbi sits around with a couple of guys at night seder, and they go over Orchos Tzedekim. Okay, to me, what it is a perush to Mishnah. As much of it is just giving a, it's sort of like a codification of Sefer Mishnah. If you really know how to read it, but first you have to get familiar with it. Anyway, of all the midos of Moshe Rabbeinu, there's one Rashi says that he struggled with. Know thyself. No, it's your weakness. Right? Some people are so weak. They know what's at stake. They know what the Chil Hashem could be. They know, and still they do it. Maybe think I'm to think about that Nebuchadnezzar, that I know what's facing him for the rest of his life. He does a good job teaching him at the vice principal. If he doesn't, I can't talk to Makarov. How do you not know what can happen to you if you get caught doing this stuff? Right? The addiction, the desire for it is so strong that it's pushed aside. If you think you're so high that you're doing it for 15 years and you're just never going to get caught. No, they know one day they're going to get caught. They're just so... Madoff said he knew he was going to get caught. He knows it. He lived every day in trepidation of knowing he's going to get caught. When Eo's friends talked to him about... Don't think that the Rishonim had it so good. They're living every day knowing that they're going to make it caught. That's no life. Yirmiyahu, chapter 12, undoes, pulls the rug out of all those arguments. I doubt you have to see that yourself. Right. So I gave you this long introduction. What's the midah? What's the midah that Moshe struggles with? Well, it wouldn't be arrogance because he was very humble. Right? Moshe rose, we say, to the higher than any Jew could possibly rise. Probably the Rambam considered that one of the tenets of our faith. Now, what if I felt, after reading Sefer Yeshayahu or reading Sefer Shmuel, that I think that Shmuel was greater than Moshe? Why does that make me a heretic, according to the Rambam? Come on, talk to me, guys. Why do you think? That makes you a heretic, according to the Rambam. You're a kofir. It's like you don't believe in Har Sinai. It's like you don't believe in Mamana. You don't believe in Yitzias Mitzrayim. Why did he include that as one of his principles of faith? And he writes at the end, if you don't believe in any one of these 13, you are not considered a Jew. It's a mitzvah to hate such a person. I'm not talking about some of the biggies. I believe that God rewards and punishes. But why do you insist that I believe that when I read Sefer Shmuel, I must believe that Shmuel is greater, that Moshe is greater than him? Where is this? Oh, come on, it should be obvious, no? Now, in the Torah it says, no one in Israel ever rose to the status of Moshe. And there's an amazing Sifrei that says, but when it comes to prophetic ability, one did. Not greater, but his equal. But look how immoral he was. And then, oh boy, the rabbis jump on him. Oh my goodness. He was a whore. He sold himself to the highest bidder to curse anybody who would hire him to do so. A very important occupation in the ancient world. Amazingly, it appears in ancient literature. Amazingly, the occupation is very close phonetically to his name, especially when L and R interchange. He was called a Barum. Barum was as important as a good soldier and a good general, because you had to curse the other side in order to win your war. And Bilam was very good at assessing which side he thought would win in advance. So he would only sell himself to the one he assessed. Like he was like, he was a whore. He sold himself to the highest bidder. And said, no, you know what? I'm not going with you because I see you're you're not, the smart money isn't that you're going to win this war. So I'm not going to curse the other one for that side. Right? And word gets around. You know, he did his homework, he knows who's going to win, but his name is Philip. But prophetic ability is not the most important thing, said Rambam. It's moral ability. Right?
So you should see what the Midrash should do about Bilam.
Get this. Try to think. This should answer the other question. Why does the Rambam think that it's a tenet of faith to believe that Moshe was the greatest all-around Jew who ever lived? Bilam dies at the age of 33. He only lived with men. He slept with his donkey. He was a sorcerer. He performed miracles for people to make them think that he is the only true leader that they should follow. Who is this? So there's a lot of scholarship on this. I must tell you that what I think is going on here is thoroughly debunked by scholars. But there's too much material. Plus, there's a German scholar who just wrote a book called Jesus and the Talmud, and he shows that this is all over the Talmud. The Christians love Philo. He's all over the Sistine Chapel. They love him not because he cursed the Jews. Christians are on the Jewish side at the time, but because Bilam makes predictions about the distant future. And they read Jesus all over his predictions. He's not predicting Jesus, said the rabbis of the Talmud. He is Jesus. I don't mean literally. Right? Whatever the rabbis, they knew they couldn't say these things about Jesus in the Talmud. By the time the Talmud is being edited and written, the Christians are ruling over the Jews with an iron thumb. If you dare say anything negative about Jesus, your whole city is going to be destroyed. So what did they do? They very cleverly said it about Bilam, and they waited and they said, if you want to know what we think about Jesus, read what we write about Bilam. I think this is plausible. I'm coming back to Moshe now. Okay? Chazal were willing to say that Moshe had an equal in prophecy. But he does not have an equal in the totality of all those meters, especially not that Jesus. Okay? I think that's why it's a tenet of faith. It could be because of Muhammad also, because Muslims claim that Muhammad also is revered in Moshe. It's full disclosure. Both those religions revere Moshe. You know that, right? Okay? They don't doubt the ancient history. They just say that there's someone who has come to supplant Moshe because we didn't follow Moshe's rules. We disobeyed his Torah. And they cite lots of good psukim in Tanakh from Yirmiyahu and others that show why we deserve to have a change. Okay? So, I still ask you, what's the Mida in Moshe? William, please.
I'm just looking up something interesting that you mentioned, because Muslims believe in a concept that is characters and names that are mentioned in the Quran, and there are only some of them that are shared with Jews. Like Moses.
I understand that. They love Avram, they love Yosef.
I don't think that they put Muhammad above Moshe. I think they equate them. On some levels, maybe they say he's the last prophet to come, but yeah. They wouldn't say that. But I'll find that out next class.
Yeah. Okay. We'll see that. But one thing is clear: they revere Moshe.
Of course.
Okay. And so is Christianity, right? So, but you had to. You see, the Muslims, we didn't really debate them on these issues, because Muslims don't revere our Torah. Certainly not our by Nevi'im and Ksuvim the way Christians do. The Torah, Nevi'im and Ksuvim are part of their Bible. It's called the Old Testament, right? We should never refer to it that way, but and it speaks to them, right? When, you know, I have a picture from Israel from 1884, 1885, around there, and it's a Muslim farm, and you see that it's Christians took these pictures. You see all the animals are muzzled with chains across their mouth as they're plowing. And the Christians write, forbidden! Not according to the law! They write on the bottom of the picture. There's no Jew there, isn't there? Because it says, Lo tachsom shor b'gishav, lech mitfash. I'm allowed to have a cow muzzled while it's working for you. Right? But the Christians believe that Deuteronomy tells. It's we. I would have a question for them. So why is that? Why that pasuk you agree with, but the sukkim to took him away from it? You don't agree with. Christians usually say we just keep the Ten Commandments, but they're not even doing that. They don't keep Shabbos. Not because I know how to keep Shabbos better than they do. They're keeping Sunday, and they know Sunday is not the Lord's day. They know Saturday. A whole group of Jews, Seventh-day Adventists and J Witnesses and stuff like that, that keep Saturday as their holy day. They work on Sunday. They don't work on Saturday. Right? The Council of Nicaea changed the God's day from Saturday to Sunday to get 325. Wait a second. Who gave them that authority? Because they realized that they had to make a total break from Jews. Until 325, Christianity or let's say Nazarenes were just a branch of Judaism. Right?
What was this called?
325? Council of Nicaea, N-I-C-E-A. So they voted on these things, but people were told in the court that how to vote. But be that as it may, I'm still trying to work out with you what's this midah that Rashi says that Moshe has a weakness. We're going to try to learn it and twist it into a positive, right? But I'm back to the Rambam. The Rambam is one of the famous, his work called Hilchos Deus, some of the Gemara Bukhim, is a masterpiece of human understanding, of what's true also, I think. But practically a lot of mada really is how the human mind works. And the Rambam says that when it comes to your, let's say, those 45 gates in the Sepharchos Tzaddikim, where should you find yourself on these gates when it comes to thrift, when it comes to enthusiasm, when it comes to the middle? The Rambam coined the term the middle of the road, right? The Shvil HaZahav, right? Okay? Don't go to extremes in any of your meetings. Sometimes you have to for this particular case. Yeah, don't stay in the middle of the road all the time and get hit by a car that way. But you have to balance all of your meetings. You're going to be somewhere good, right? So you could be yotzei schar v'hafsedo by being too extreme on anything. Right? Norman Lamb used to say, "I'm extreme about my moderation." Okay, so. But the Rambam says that I have two of the midos, and you will see it very interesting. Rambam doesn't make this connection, but Shimshon for Hirschberg's many hundreds of years later. But these two are actually connected. Does anybody remember learning in a Musar class what are the two that the Rambam allows you to go to an extreme? Not that tells you must go to extreme.
One anger.
Anger. Ha'as. The other one is Gaifa. Now, I don't mean like a slabodka kind of guy, you know, they would walk like this, you know, just to be, I'm a nothing, I'm a zero, I'm a nothing, right? And they'd say, look at that guy, he thinks he's a zero, he's not good enough to be a zero. You know, so you know, that's getting a little too far, I think. I think you're not. No, I'm not sure what its source, but in one pocket you have to have a little note that says, Anochi Afar Ve'efer, I am dust and ashes. The other pocket says, Bishvili Nivra Olam, the world was created for me. Those are extremes, right? You know? But if you have both of those in your pockets, you'll find yourself some moderation of what you're doing here. Right? Tikvas Enosh Rima, says Ravitas in Pirkei Avos. It's actually a pasuk in Mishnah Ben Sira, which is a shir unto itself, but okay. Tikvas Enosh Rima, the worm is going to be the best of all of us. Or I think King Lear said it well. Many a pauper ate fish, caught with a worm that ate the flesh of kings. Then a pauper ate fish caught with a worm that ate the flesh of kings. So, what kind of gaiva am I supposed to have? A worm is going to eat me one day. So, Shem Shurim 4 verse made the connection between Kaas and Gaiva. Can you feel it? Because what's the source of Kaas? Who's the first person in the Bible that gets angry?
Cain.
Why does he get angry?
Because
he's jealous. Right? But the jealousy is caused by a sense that I'm not getting the respect and recognition that I think I deserve. Right? The more sophisticated person might look at that and say, oh, why isn't God giving me what he's giving him, whatever that is? I better try harder. Instead, God actually comes to him and tells him that. But the person might say, okay, you know, I recognize, you know, I see mine, this is so much better. But then, you know, you start to think, but I did it first. Why don't I get some respect for that? Right? I think the answer to that question is a powerful message. You should have asked him to join you. Why did you do this by yourself? He needs God as much as you do. Yes, your sentiment in wanting to give something back to me is a good one. Right? It's a worthwhile one. But if you feel that you needed my favor for your crops to grow properly, why didn't you offer you bring it to your younger brother, since he also needs God, needs me, for his sheep to do well? What were you thinking? With me? All right, so God gives him a pep talk about how you can make yourself better. But he's angry. Angry to the point of wanting to kill his brother. Maybe he doesn't even know what that means at this point. But I'm amazed at God, who doesn't convince him not to do so with some more powerful language, like kind of notes in your head. If you do that, I'll squash you to a million pieces. And I'm going to give you 1 second, 1 millisecond of the pain you'll be in for the rest of your life if you do kill him tomorrow. Got it? Beep. Oh, I'm not killing him tomorrow. Well, give him the carrot. Forget about the stick. Say, Cain, I want you to feel this pleasure that you can have for 3 seconds. Ready? 1, 2, 3. You're God. You can do anything. Give him some, I don't know, give him a massage chair. Give him some great pleasure. Right? And say, Cain, if you try harder, that's what I did for Hevel, and that's what I can do for you. Instead, God just said, tells him, Cain, I know what's in your head. And I know that sin is crouching at the door. If you try harder, you will succeed. What do you think Cain did the next day? He kills his brother, right? Says, "V'yam Cain will have a lochiba." He becomes a sadeh. V'yam Cain will have a lochiba. You get you, and everyone tries to struggle with what was said there. Why was the pasuk said "V'yam Cain will have a lochiba" without telling us what was said? Okay. Good one. I read the text, especially the double repetition of achiv and the heder of what was said, that it's not written in the pasuk, right? I read that as saying that Cain went to his brother and asked for help. He gave in on his gaiva, right? I deserve the respect my brother got, right? It's not easy. I'm lowering myself to ask my younger brother what he did to get God's favor. And I think what Hevel responded, although I wasn't there, but this is what we do in Drash. Hevel's response was, I'm not helping you. I like where I am right now. You taught me competition by not bringing me along. Just think how human history might have been different. Hevel would have told Cain, don't bring that. That's not a good carpet to bring. Let me show you what I'm bringing, and you bring something just as good. Right? If you and then it's not, I'm not going to go further with it, but if you look what Cain brings and what Hevel brings, there's a lot of differences in the Lashon to show why Hevel's is better. It's not arbitrary. Right? Okay, so it could be that, you know, that Cain gives in on his gaiva to go to his brother to ask for advice. Right? So when you're angry and you're not getting what you expect, you would expect, what you think you need because of your gaiva, right? That leads to depression. Hashem doesn't just say lama chara lacha. He says also the lama. You get another pasuk. The lama naflu panecha. Naflu panecha means why are you depressed, right? Isn't there just two words that are synonymous? Why are you angry? Anger is supposed to get us to do something. Let me get satisfaction, right? I'm going to write a letter. And if I get no response and no reaction to my anger, that leads to depression. So okay. Hopefully depression sometimes prevents you from dealing with the situation. So God comes to him and gets him out of the depression and says, there's a better day out there for you, Cain. Go and do something. And he goes to his brother and Hevel doesn't respond. So his anger gets him to act impulsively. I don't know if he meant to kill him or not. He says he shed a lot of blood, a lot of blood all over me. He didn't know what he was doing, maybe. Right? Okay. Rashi says, "Kol demei achecha," because not just your brother, it's the future descendants. But it also could be that he hit him a million times until he was cut into a 100 pieces. He didn't know what he was doing. Right? Anyway, the real, if that's true, then the real punishment of Cain comes because he didn't break down when God said, "Where's your brother?" He was, "God, I don't know what I did. I just got so angry with him and I just started hitting him and hitting him. And he's lying there and..." No, there's no contrition. Right? Okay. Does everybody here feel comfortable being able to articulate how this discussion of Cain connects Ka'as and Gaiva? Ka'as comes to you when you feel you're not getting what you deserve. If someone is a real Anav does not get angry. Okay? Or a real Anav just saves anger for some very, very specific times. Right? The Rambam would say, no, you can never be angry, you can never be Gabal Gaiva. Right? Okay, now one of these, Moshe, is called the greatest Anav of anybody who has ever lived at that time. And it's Tam of all time. Because when you get so close to Hashem, you realize how zero you are. You realize, look at this, here's the amoeba, here's me, and there's God across the ocean. Okay? Are you with me? The more you see what that is, whatever all the mitos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you come to realize what a zero I am. So it makes perfect sense that the one who gets closest to Hashem is the one who's the most honored. Right? So here's what Shimshon Farhersh says. He says that it is actually a great testament to Moshe that he was able to control. Now I'm giving an answer. What was the one weakness of Moshe that you see keep coming up again and again and again?
Confidence.
Okay, that's an important midah to have. Just make sure that confidence is realistic. When Moshe lacks confidence, it's because he's right about that. But what? That's the first thing we did, with the emotion, Moshe not believing that he is up for the task. Was that driven by his extreme humility, or was it driven by realism? God, why are you taking someone who either doesn't speak the language so well anymore because they haven't spoken the word of Egyptian in 60 years, or does, you know, bless you, I have a lisp, or I have some other defect according to some other commentaries, right? Or I just don't have a way with words. I mean, get someone else who's been speaking Egyptian all these years, right? I'm just trying to you know, Moshe does not say something like, "God, you're God. Surely you would choose only the best man for the job, so I'm with you. Instead, Moshe gives five excuses. You know why I think we discussed it. You know, we did the first very first week. Shmos 3, his apprehension. Week 2, Moshe's apprehensions. So the midah is anger. Moshe gets angry. Bichar af Moshe is written a number of times in the Torah. Okay? And the commentary, what Rashi does is that whenever Moshe gets angry, he does something wrong. He gets something wrong. Okay? And sometimes Hashem has to step in and tell him what's wrong. Sometimes the reader can plainly see in the narrative something's wrong. Right? But sometimes there's a hint that something's wrong. Okay? So let's create a list. Now, by the way, when I say something wrong, what I mean is the following. This is just is part of a fact of life. We do all kinds of things, make all kinds of decisions. Sometimes we make like a checklist. What are the pros and the cons? Right? Should I move into this house? Should I move into that house? Should I date that girl? Should I date that girl? Should I buy this car? Should I buy that car? Right? And you build pros and cons. Right? According to one reading of this pasuk, Adamin Tzadik Baratz Asher Yaseh Tov Lo Yaseh Tov, nobody does anything perfectly. It doesn't mean that you can't go through your whole lifetime without sinning. What it means is that everything you do is never 100% on one side. That's the thing to do. There's always a debate. There's always, hopefully, if you're 51% right, you're a tzaddik, right? You'd be 51% of the time right, go to Wall Street, make a lot of money. Right? Maybe 60% of the time right. But I'm just saying is that everything, but when you're 60% right, you're still 40% wrong. Right? Okay, there's still someone that thinks this is not the right decision, or something to pay for this decision. Right? Isn't that what we discussed last class about Aaron making the egel? Right? That decision was very close, maybe 55-45. But once Aaron determined that we're going to suffer as a people more if I don't make this ego, right? Aaron didn't be able to just be some kind of symbol for God. They turned it into something more. Okay? So they started offering to it, they started bowing to it. It became such a whole, not just a symbol, but a representation of God. It wasn't that on his arms. Okay. Alright, so what would be the first time that it seems Moshe is acting on anger? It doesn't say so in the pasuk, but what do you know? I think this story where the Egyptian is beating a Hebrew. If you would see this, and you're a prince or someone important, an official, an Egyptian, what would you do? You see this? What? Really? You just kill the Egyptian? You would not? You wouldn't go, wouldn't you go to the Egyptian and say, hey, God, what are you doing? Do you see who I am? Right in front of you. He goes, oh, Moses, oh, I'm so sorry. You bow to him, and he can say, I mean, he's raised in a palace. I don't think he was as great as the movie The Ten Commandments makes him, but still, he had to run away from his life when he did. You know, an Egyptian prince probably can kill anyone in the human world, right? The movie very cleverly makes it so that he's able to he has to run away because it's discovered that he's actually a Hebrew. Right? And even when he's discovered that he's Hebrew, Pyro comes in and says, Moses,
I forgive everything. But just look me in the face and say that you wouldn't want to destroy Egypt for the sake of your people. And Moshe said, I'm not sure what's compelling me to do this, but if I could free them, I would. And then Pharaoh says, get out of here. It's very clever. In the text, he just seems to get in trouble for what he did. I would have gone to the Egyptian and say, excuse me, we can't be doing things like this to these people. They're human beings. Get out of here. Leave them alone. And go on. Right? And then maybe he'd go to the next story. And say, it says he went out to see his brethren. How are my people doing now that I know I'm a Hebrew? Right? The Torah doesn't say how he learned these Hebrew. Right? Okay, what I want to do is maybe Parshas Noach, Alech Lecha, beginning of November. All five of you come to me for Shabbos. Everybody's Shabbos. Right? Come to the west side, go to the next west side Shabbos. And Motzei Shabbos, we're going to watch the Ten Commandments. Right? If the clock change, it'll be early enough, okay? We're good?
Yeah.
I have a whole study guide of how it depicts Moshe. Right? We're not going to watch the whole thing, we'll stick around, okay? You're going to do that? Maybe Noach Aleich Lecha? Write down the date, Noach Aleich Lecha, and we'll do it, alright? Full disclosure, my son's wife is due around that time, so if I can go for a bris, so Shabbos, we'll see. But right now, Noach Aleich Lecha looks pretty safe, right? Just choose one of those two Shabboses, alright? I want to do it only 4 or 5 if you can make it. Okay, good? We make up a WhatsApp group here. Class.
Noah is the second of the ninth.
Okay. Second or the ninth. Okay. I think the ninth we have a scholar resident at Shul, but that's fine. That's fine. It means that someone else will be speaking with Shabbos morning. Okay. Okay. Figure that. Maybe the ninth will be better because depends when she's speaking. Okay. We'll figure it out as we get closer. All right, so Moshe struggles with anger. He does things when he gets angry that are, I'll tell you, the word I'm going to use is, you know, again, I give trepidation. Who am I to judge Moshe? I think impulsive. Impulsivity was very much looked down upon by the rabbis. Right? So I think that when he sees the Egyptian beating the Hebrew, it just overcomes him. He is taken with rage. The same rage, this is now Rabbah. It's Rashi who says in each case something was wrong. We should have done something differently. And what we have to do, of course, in each case is to figure out what's wrong. What's the function? It doesn't say in the Pasuk, but Yas Hara Beinei Hashem, except when he hit the rock. Parshas Sukkas, if your sister died. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't say, and God said, Moshe, you did something wrong when you got angry with your brother. No pasuk like that. Just that you got the halacha wrong. He also gets angry when the people finish the war against Midian. Since he got angry with them because they let women live. Right? And children. And he got angry with them. That's it. And what's the next pasuk? It says, and God told Elazar, whatever vessels you took from the Midianites, you have to dip in water, you're going to feel us came from Elazar, not from Moshe. So Rashi writes, why didn't Moshe teach these words? Usually it's right version of Moshe anymore. Yeah, it's right version of Elazar, very strange. So what does it teach? Moshe couldn't teach it. He was angry. He showed that he had a bout of anger. He forgot it. He couldn't be the vessel to teach the next law. That's Rashi. Ramban says the same Moshe that hit the Egyptian in story number one there is the same Moshe that broke down the Luchos. And the same Moshe that takes the rock. The action was sometimes so overcome that he just lost it. I mean, that's, you know. I want to close today's presentation, we just have a few more minutes, with a
important rendition of a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. It says, Arba Midos V'Deos. There are four different types of Deos. Hilchos Deos, we started this class with, right? He said, if someone, so it's Ka'as and Nisur, anger and appeasement. Okay? So there are four different types of people. Someone who is easy to anger, okay, and easy to appease. So this is a 46. Because he gets angry a lot. He's angry all the time. But you can calm him down in 2 seconds. Listen, you do. In other words, that's his nature. He's like slippery. He goes quickly from one, from I'm calm, and I get angry very easily, and then I calm down very easily. But because he gets angry so often, it's not good. If someone gets angry very rarely, right, but holds on to the anger, right, I understand that Nida also. He's 60-40. That's better than the first guy. Because even though he holds on to his anger, a few days maybe, that's a little better because he only gets angry four times a year. But when he gets angry, in other words, he's measured, he's not impulsive. He gets angry probably maybe for good things, but then be careful because he's going to stay angry for a while. You get it? It's kosher lechos, but also kosher leratzos. I hope you're all getting this, right? Right? Okay? Then the Mishnah, you're familiar with these Mishnayos, right? It gives you four different things, and then Shalishalishalishalishalishal, right? Perkei and Pirkei Avos, right? This is Perkei Mishnah Yudal. And then it says, if you're quick to anger, but difficult to appease, what are you? You're quick to, you get angry all the time. And you hold on to that, forget about the fact that you're probably a miserable person, and you're depressed all the time, based on what we said earlier. Right? If you get angry easily, you're getting angry all the time, and you hold on to it long, what do we call that person? What does the Mishnah call that person? Is it Rasha? Right? This person rarely gets angry. And even though he rarely gets angry, quickly gets appeased, that person is Chassid. So I leave you for today with the following question. And this will be our introduction to week number 4, which we're going to do next week. So that means in the first 5 weeks, we will have done 1, 2, 3, 4, 7. Is, why does the Mishnah refer to anger and appeasement in moral terms? Rasha and Chassid describe moral descriptions. I would have preferred, maybe don't speak in Hebrew, but speak in English. Find me two more appropriate terminologies. Someone who's quick to anger and difficult to appease is impulsive, foolish, even foolish. Pesi is a terminology Mishle uses all the time for that kind of person. He's a pesi, he's a pursuit, he's a... And I think, you know what? Hold on a second. I think that by calling him pesi, it shows that it's related to the word pit'om. Shemep soyim? Right? Pit'om means suddenly. He suddenly gets angry, he's a pesi. Right? Impetuous. Impetuous is foolish. So why refer to him in moral terms? You should refer to him in midos, not morality. So that's going to go a long way to answer to taking this discussion about Moshe. So I have given an assignment for you. Find 5 places in the Torah that you think Moshe is acting under anger. If you have trouble, just take Barak's concordance here. Get yourself a concordance and look up the word charak. Right? But they should come to you. It's the Rock of Zor, the Bamidbar, Korach, look at Parshas Baloscha. You'll see a few, alright? Find me 5 cases. I hope that between all of you, we'll cover everything. Alright? Okay, guys, have a great day. Today is September 19th. Okay.